And people get very upset and discouraged when their personal convictions come under critical scrutiny, particularly if they've based their faith on a particular given miracle in their family life. If that has become the apologetic that led them to Christ, it's quite difficult to then analyse and step back from it. Now, I want to say at the outset that this has been for me a personal and necessary journey. When I was 14, I found myself waking up each morning with worsening headaches, and then double vision and vomiting set in, and I was admitted to Guy's Hospital in London, where in 1960, the dates are quite important in this story, they did an air encephalogram, which was the best they could do, which showed a space-occupying lesion consistent with a brain tumour. My father broke the news to me. He said it was either benign or malignant, and if it was the latter, the outlook was very poor. So you can imagine the impact that this had on me and on my family and on all our friends. On the day of the operation, my father, who was not a churchgoer, found a church in central London near his office, and he went in to pray. It was an overcast day, and the church was empty, dark, and silent. He later took me back to show me the scene. Emotionally distraught, he sat in a pew, closed his eyes, and did his very best to pray. And eventually he said, and somewhat exhausted, he lifted his head and opened his eyes. At that moment, he said, two things happened simultaneously. The sun came out, flooding the chancel with coloured light from the stained glass windows. But more remarkably, believing himself to be utterly alone, the organ started playing at full volume. Impacted by light and sound, he returned to his office with new hope. He believed this was a sign that God would heal me. An hour or so later, he had a call from work from the surgeon, who was still in his theatre gown and mask, but felt compelled to phone at once, reporting that, to his great surprise, he'd found only a subdural hematoma, which he'd drained successfully and anticipated a complete recovery. Friends and family saw this as a miracle. No one had expected it. But as I went on to study A-level sciences, I had to ask myself, with all due respect to that institute, Guy's Hospital, whether it was a miracle for a Guy's surgeon to make a wrong diagnosis. Five years later at medical school, I heard a surgeon saying that he was seeing patients with breast cancer arriving at his clinic too late to be cured because they'd wasted time in searching for a miracle. And I thought this was tragic and enormously damaging to Christian credibility. And later I would discover other lurking dangers. Yes, delays in getting treated, but then there were the people who stopped their treatments. Patients who blamed themselves for their lack of faith when they weren't healed. The financial cost to the patient. I think of one man, he was a headmaster in a school in Southampton. He went all the way to Nigeria to find a particular healer who was a specialist at his sort of tumour. The profit to the healer, I think of an American healer who used to come over to London with his entire team flying by Concorde. And then I think of the abuse of the vulnerable, the elderly, the simple-minded, the poor, and most of all, the children. I therefore set out to investigate whether there was any evidence of miracle healings occurring today. And this is not the sort of research subject that lends itself to randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trials. The best I could do was to investigate the best cases and see what they showed. They tended to be flagged up in media reports, written about in books, where usually the best case was referred to at the beginning but described at the end. So they were easy to identify. And when it came to professional healers and healing organizations, I learned to ask them for their three best cases, because to ask for a single case could prove to be a bad example. But if they chose their three best cases, then we would have a real idea of what was going on. In order to do this, I had to satisfy myself what a miracle might look like if I ever found one. We've already considered how definitions are problematic. Recently, Dr. Brian D. Rikus has described his definition in terms of a supernatural intervention to alter the natural course of events, which I don't think helps us very much. While Dr. Rex Gardner defined a miracle as the healing of an organic disease by means or at a speed inexplicable medically. But doctors are often surprised by inexplicable medical outcomes. So definitions are fraught with problems. Descriptions seem to me to be a much better way forward. In 1735, Cardinal Lambertini, who went on to become Pope Benedict XIV, listed five criteria. Miracles in the Gospels, he said, generally shared these five features. The illness was incurable, such as congenital blindness, kyphosis of the spine, a wasted arm, paralyzed legs, death of 4 days' duration. And secondly, these conditions were generally non-remitting. Exceptions to that would be epilepsy and menorrhagia, which might, in the natural course of events, have settled down. Most conditions could not resolve spontaneously. And thirdly, they were healed instantaneously, usually at a word of command. Two gospel examples have very short delays, but apart from those two, all the others happened immediately, is the commonest word that's used to describe it. And fourthly, there was no other therapy to account for the recovery. Saliva and mud on the eyes would not in itself be therapeutic. And fifthly, the healing was complete. The deaf man didn't have to cup his ear in order to hear what was being said to him. The paralyzed man didn't limp away, leaning on the arm of a friend, leaving someone else to carry his bed. So if people are claiming to see Christ-like miracles, and that's usually what they imply by using the word miracle, what other miracle workers might they have in mind? Then we do need to establish these central criteria. Curable diseases that respond to routine treatments, that are liable to get better on their own, that may gradually improve over weeks or months, that have already received effective treatments, or diseases that have only partially recovered, are thereby disqualified from consideration. They might constitute unexpected and remarkable answers to prayer, for which we should thank God, or they should thank God, like the healing of my subdural hematoma, but these were not Christ-like miracles. I did not have a brain tumor, which vanished suddenly. I wrote up my first investigation some 40 years ago and have engaged in public discussion on the subject ever since. And so it was in 1992, I was invited to take part in an ITN News discussion with the American faith healer Maurice Sorello. The subject was national news because he had put up posters all over London implying that the blind would see with broken glasses and a snapped white stick, the lame would walk, a wheelchair thrown over on its side, and the deaf would hear a discarded hearing aid. People were furious with the posters. In the interview, when eventually I got a word in edgeways, I asked him to produce his three best cases from the week and put them forward for public scrutiny. In the event, and after a great deal of delay and obfuscation on his part, he offered 7 cases, which were then examined by Joan Bakewell's BBC Heart of the Matter team, for which I acted as medical advisor. The programme, which revealed our findings, was seen by 4.7 million people, which I was told was a record for that very successful series. There was a lot of public interest in this. What did we find? A woman healed of low back pain was taken back to her orthopedic surgeon, who demonstrated that there was no change in her x-rays. But her depression had lifted, and she had become more mobile. Being mobile with low back pain is very key to recovery. A woman anxious that she had a recurrence of a melanoma actually had a small inflamed cyst which had burst itself and healed spontaneously. A small child had his spectacles taken away because his parents believed he'd been healed. And a woman believed she'd been healed of a fibroid, but we soon established that she had never had a fibroid. While Natalia Barnett, 4-year-old, with metastatic neuroblastoma, who was made to run up and down the stage in tears to demonstrate that she was healed, died just 2 months later from her disease. And a 25-year-old woman called Audrey Reynolds stopped her epilepsy medication, and 6 days later she had a fit in the bath and drowned. The coroner, Sir Montague Levine, said, "It is a tragedy that she went to this meeting and thought she'd been cured of everything. Sadly, it led to her death." The BBC inquiry led to a wider investigation into Serallo's organisation, and I wrote a detailed report on this, which was published only in America, but copies of it are available for here today. If it's not just of historic interest, these people are still alive and kicking. The latest one you can research on the internet is the antics of Peter Popoff, who has been resurrected, having been shown to be fraudulent years ago, and is now campaigning as he ever did. Other inquiries included Jennifer Rees-Larkham, who published a book entitled Unexpected Healing, in which she claimed to be miraculously healed of a neurological disease like MS. She gave me signed permission to see her case notes, but then briefed her GP not to send them to me. So I took the chance about a year later just to send the consent form to the GP again and see what happened. And he accepted at face value and sent me all her medical papers. The neurological tests in her case were all normal, and my report, which was published in the Church of England newspaper, caused a furore, and if you want to read it, it is there to be seen. She's still making the same claims, I think. Reinhard Bonker made dramatic claims on a video about a Mrs. Jean Neal, who I managed to talk to on the phone, and she then sent me, for some reason, she had all sorts of medical papers, including x-ray reports, and I was able to investigate her in some detail. Her claims completely collapsed in a hopeless manner, and there is a detailed writing up of that story that you can take a copy if you would like. Rex Gardner had collected 22 cases that he'd gathered from all around the world, which he published in a book called Healing Miracles. It gained credibility when he published a summary of his findings in the Christmas coffee table edition of the British Medical Journal. And he also presented the claims on television. His best case was a spontaneous recovery from nerve deafness of a child, a phenomenon that I'd never come across before. But when I asked an ENT surgical friend of mine whether he had ever seen such things happen, he immediately sent me a paper that he himself had written on the subject, and then he invited me to attend an ENT conference on the phenomenon. It seems it happens only occasionally, and it's not well understood, though I have come across a similar case in Southampton since. None of the other cases in Dr. Gardner's book were anything like as interesting as this child. And in fact, two of his cases had died of their diseases in the year the book was published. I have a filing cabinet stuffed full of correspondence on miracle claims. So I'm only able to give you headlines today, but I have provided details if you want to follow up on some of these headlines. I was grateful to a journalist who asked to see all my papers, and we spent a happy day wading through this stuff. And he asked me at the end if I had, where was my file on Lourdes? And I shamefacedly said, I haven't got a file on Lourdes. And he said, then you're an idiot. And I thought he was right. So I rectified that and went to the south of France and met Dr. Theodore Mangiapane, who had been clinical director of Lourdes for 18 years. I took an interpreter, and we had a long and interesting discussion under the shade of the trees on his patio. To date, there have been 69 official claims of miracles from Lourdes from the millions of sick people who go there in search of a cure. The reason why my subdural hematoma was misdiagnosed in 1960 is because of the very limited diagnostic tools available then. Today, we have CT and MRI scans. And I don't know whether you noticed when you drove up here and parked the car. Did you see the blue plaque on the wall? You missed it. Fortunately, I had that inquiry. I thought, what's a blue plaque doing on an industrial estate like this? The magnetic component that led to MRI scans was developed here in 1980, which I thought was fascinating. Prior to 1960, there were no useful diagnostic tools remotely comparable. CT scans hadn't been developed. But today, of course, we have a wealth of technology to give really accurate diagnoses. So it's therefore not surprising that prior to 1960, there were a tremendous number of claims of miracles at Lourdes, but there have only been seven in the last 50 years. They include Vittorio Micheli, Lourdes miracle number 63. He had a spontaneous remission of a bone cancer in his hip, which took place very gradually and led him to finish up with a displaced hip joint where he walks with a marked limp. Sergei Perin, the 64th case, was thought to have had a stroke, but his physical signs and symptoms never married up. Crucial tests were normal, and he displayed what psychiatrists call la belle indifférence. It's a characteristic of hysterics that they seem strangely at ease with their ill health. And Dr. Mangiapane seemed very reluctant to discuss him. Jean-Pierre Belli, miracle number 66 on the Lord's book, was believed to have multiple sclerosis, but the one person on the medical committee who voted against his healing being miraculous was the neurologist. He did not feel the diagnosis had been established beyond significant doubt. Today, MRI scans are crucial in making that diagnosis. Eventually, I asked Dr. Mangiapane, who's written the definitive book on the healing of Lourdes, which he thought was the most impressive of them all. And he said it was number 65. Delizia Ciroli was a 12-year-old Sicilian girl who features on the front cover of his book. She had a tumor in her knee, which was diagnosed as a neuroblastoma, but her parents refused to allow her to have the leg amputated, which would have been the only possible medical cure. So she went back home from Lourdes as if to die. But 6 months later, she got off her sickbed and began to walk and never looked back. I asked Dr. Mangiapane when she was next x-rayed, and he thought it was about 6 months after this recovery. I said, well, was it healed then? He said, no, it wasn't. But it was gradually resolving, and neither did it recover completely. She subsequently needed orthopedic surgery to straighten out her deformed leg. I pointed out to him that neuroblastomas have the greatest incidence of spontaneous remission of any childhood cancers. And he disputed the diagnosis. He said that he thought it wasn't a neuroblastoma. He thought it was a Ewing sarcoma and did not believe a single case of spontaneous remission had ever been reported for that condition. Some months later, I was interviewed for a Channel 4 Equinox documentary on the miracles of Lourdes. And I told them that Delicia Ciroli was the key case, and they should try and get the histological slides from her tumor and bring them to a London oncologist. And they managed to do this. They presented them to Dr. Kathy Pritchard-Jones, a consultant pediatric oncologist at the Royal Marsden. But I had to wait to the end of their film to hear what she had to say. She reported that the tissue was completely undifferentiated, leading her to conclude that it could well have been a bone infection such as tuberculosis rather than a tumor, for which it eventually resolved itself spontaneously. Independent of Lourdes, the Vatican requires evidence of two miracles before beatifying and canonizing a saint. A Canadian hematologist, Jacelyn Duffin, went on study leave to the Vatican to research these cases. However, she wasn't allowed to see any medical papers subsequent to 1939. All these files were locked away from her in secret Vatican archives, which rendered her book a very vague discussion of endless uncertainties. Pre-war diagnostics were not a precise science. So I was intrigued when the Pope came to Britain in 2010 to beatify Cardinal Henry Newman. Knowing that he had been based in Birmingham, I chanced my arm by phoning the Birmingham Oratory and asked if they had a copy of the Presidio, the Vatican medical history of the case of the man who had prayed to Cardinal Newman. And if so, could I visit the oratory and have a little look at it? "Oh," said a very kind gentleman, "you can't come all from Southampton to Birmingham. You can't come all the way here. I've got a spare copy. I'll send it to you." And so, to my great surprise and delight, I have a copy of the Vatican documents concerning the beatification of Cardinal Henry Newman. The patient in question had prayed to Cardinal Newman because of his back pain. He had degenerative lumbar disc disease, causing severe central compression of his spinal cord, and eventually he had a routine surgical decompressive laminectomy and was discharged pain-free within a week. There was nothing remarkable about his illness, his operation, or his recovery. Back in 1992, Sir John Horton set up an inquiry of over 30 doctors, pastors, healers, ethicists, and theologians, including two bishops, to examine the issues of cure and care in Christian healing. Papers were circulated in advance, and the consultation met four times over the next 3 years. It was in this context that I was pressed to report on all the cases put forward by Rex Gardner's book, and my notes are available here for anyone who is interested to look at them. Various cases were presented to the Horton Inquiry, but no case of miraculous healing could be substantiated by medical evidence. The diabetics still had sugar in their urine. The cancers had not been eradicated. And a strawberry nevus, which should normally have faded within a couple of years, was still visible after 12 years. Michael Poole presented his case at that time, and which he describes in his excellent little book on miracles. And given that he has led on this matter, I will continue to comment. His case concerned a woman who had been miraculously healed of multiple sclerosis. So let me explain why I don't accept Michael's diagnosis on this, Michael's verdict on this. The diagnosis, it seems to me, was made by the patient. Michael says it was made by the GP. but this is not a GP diagnosis. It is beyond their pay scale. It can be very difficult, even for a specialist, to diagnose multiple sclerosis. And without MRI scans, it was always liable to be speculative. And this healing, I think, happened, and I'm sure Michael will correct me if that's not the case. He said 35 years ago, which brings us back to the development of MRI scans in this building in 1980. Her GP certainly thought she needed investigation and had her admitted to a neurological unit, but we do not know what they concluded. At least, it isn't in the book. Her GP subsequently referred to her illness as her condition, which to my suspicious mind sounded very vague, as though a clear diagnosis had still not been made. But the final blow to my credulity was the fact the girl's father didn't believe it either. Had he not visited her in hospital, had he not talked to her doctors, if this was a clear-cut case of MS, he would be a very odd man to deny that in his daughter. So we only have her word to go on, and one of the lessons I've learned is that that isn't enough. Since 1990, everyone in the UK has the right of access to their medical records and can request copies of hospital letters, consultant opinions, reports of investigations. Miracle claims, in my view, should not be published nowadays without authoritative scientific documentation. Ernest Lucas and I were entrusted with the task of agreeing a chapter on the significance of Jesus' healing miracles to be included in the final report of the Horton consultation entitled Christian Healing, What Can We Believe? It was published by SBCK in 1997, and I'm grateful that Ernest did all the work. However, we did run into a disagreement. Ernest wanted to say, the Christ-like miracles today are rare. But I countered, if we cannot find a single one, how can we say they're rare? It's more than we know. More recently, Dr. Mary Self in 2001 published her story. Yes, this was certainly an answer to very anxious prayers in what was an agonizing story. She feared that a lesion shown on a scan of her pelvis was a metastasis from a previous bone cancer which had required the amputation of her leg. But the biopsy of this lesion was inconclusive. And over the next few months, the lesion gradually faded and disappeared. Her consultant wrote, "She's saying it's a miracle. I'm saying it's unexplained." It's important to say that we do not have proof that this was a metastasis in the pelvis. And finally, I must comment on the story of there's Mary Self, published in all sorts of papers, telling her fascinating story. But now, finally, I must say something about Mrs. Jean Smith. She was reported in Alpha News in June 2000 as having been healed of blindness. The story itself is not compelling, and it speaks strangely of her having mirrors in the back of her eyes. So I wrote to the editor, Mr. Elston Dew, asking whether he had published the story without checking it, or if it had been validated by an ophthalmologist, why did he not publish the medical opinion? And I urged him to get the story validated, and if it was true, to publish it with the full weight of the medical evidence. He did not reply to me. And I've since learned that it was never validated. Yet for the past 16 years, this story has continued to be told by the Alpha Course all over the world. It's held up as their best example of a healing ministry, chosen from many. The Alpha Course is a precious resource for the church, and I'm a fan, and the new films that are coming out at the moment of the new course are excellent that I've seen so far. But they do need to validate this miracle or remove it from the program. The struggle to establish the truth must be the first line of priority for Christians in every discipline. Truth is always on our side. Jesus said, I'm the truth, and he called his disciples to follow the truth. And before Pilate, he said, I came into this world to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. It follows that lies, exaggerations, deceptions are always short of his standard. And we cannot promote the gospel on the basis of wishful thinking, sloppiness in investigation, or outright deception. Even if we conclude that God has not wrought a Christ-like miracle for hundreds of years, we do not know what he might do before this day is out. His hands are not tied, but we should look and take careful note of what he is doing. If a miracle did occur, it would most likely be immediately self-evident. If a man born blind regained his sight, it would be astonishing to everyone who knew him, and it would be the talk of the town. I have a wheelchair-bound friend with osteogenesis imperfecta. My wife pushes her to church in the wheelchair most weeks. I'm not allowed to push her because I go too fast over the bumps and it hurts her like mad. She's very anxious about the speed she moves at. She has tiny, frail, fragile limbs. If she walked into church one day, there'd be uproar. It would soon be all over the news bulletins and the story spread across the world of somebody healed of such a disease. If my spinal kyphosis was cured, you would all know it immediately. I'd be 4 inches taller and my mouth wouldn't be near enough to the microphone. When Jesus healed the paralyzed man and lowered him through the roof, Mark records that everyone was amazed. And they praised God, saying, we've never seen anything like this. Our prayers for healing and our counseling of those who are sick need to be faithful, wise, and circumspect in regard to the truth in general and science in particular. We need to read the book of nature as well as the book of scripture to learn what God is actually doing in the world and how he chooses to fulfill his purposes. If we reduce Christ's miracles to the vagaries of alternative therapy, we degrade Christ and deceive his people. We must help Christians to see science as a means God has given us to have dominion over all the earth, not least in matters of health. Thank you.
Can you tell us, Peter Bussey, can you tell us, please, your opinion about the placebo effect?
Well, I went to a lecture this week where a Danish doctor was arguing the case that whenever you get these placebo-controlled trials, they never compare them to someone who hasn't had placebo. So he's very skeptical the placebo means anything at all. We don't know whether those who haven't had the placebo would do just as well as those who have the placebo. Clearly, there are psychological things. If you believe you're getting better, you get more exercise, you have more confidence eating. You know, there are clearly the mental situation of the patient is very important. So it wouldn't surprise me if placebos help, but no one's ever demonstrated it scientifically, as far as I know.
Considerable disagreement with many other people. I just want to, you're clearly not going to argue that. I don't know what the truth is because I'm not a medic, but there are a lot of people who would not agree with what you've just said,
Sorry, which part of what I've just said? Well, the placebo does work for many people, or the placebo doesn't work for people?
You don't believe in the placebo effect?
No, I said, I didn't say whether or not I believe it. I don't know. The jury's out on that. The science has not been done. Thank you. Jeff Bagley.
I've often heard people claim that the healing has been in the mental attitude to the disease rather than the actual physical sort of symptoms. Would you care to comment as to whether, you know, if someone's got a better mental attitude to their condition, whether that's a miracle, if it's the answer to prayer?
Well, certainly our mental attitude does have a lot to do with our health. And we see in general practice many people who turn their face to the wall. They've given up on life. Their family life has ended. Their life is surrounded by tragedy. They've got no useful purpose. And one isn't surprised to learn 6 months later they've died of a cancer. There seems to be something inevitable in it. We also see people who really determined to get better, who make more effort, who get the exercise, who get the medical attention that they need, who eat better, and because they've had exercise, they also sleep better. And all these are key in recovering from almost any sort of illness, whether it's a psychological one or an infection or a cancer. So mental state is very important, and Christians hopefully will have a more positive attitude to their health and well-being and therefore their recovery.
Hello, I'm Elizabeth Cole. Thank you very much for that. I really agree with knowing what the truth is. The truth is critically important. But I wonder if you'd like to comment on, you know, there is very specific texts in the letters, for example, saying in the New Testament, you know, those who are sick will be healed. And I wonder if you could comment on that.
Well, I think I would want to take you to a specific text and let us see what it really says. It certainly says in James that we should pray for those who are sick. And it says, I think, happily, ambiguously, God will raise him up. And whether that is in this life or in the next life, that seems to be set open. So when I'm praying for somebody who has got cancer and is on their deathbed, God will raise them up, and they need to put their hope in Christ. I don't think that there is a verse that says that our prayers will necessarily be answered, that, and we have to anyway understand our prayers in terms of God's will, that we need to pray according to his will, and that, okay, it's a let out, but it's also a profound theological truth. We are all going to die. The time is going to come, and we don't want to be struggling away at this point. Come to terms with it. The people who die most happily are people who are just content to die. They've lived their lives, they're content that this is God's lot for them, and they're not fighting.
Let's go over to the other side of the room. I'm sorry, I'm glad this has provoked so many questions.
Howard Emmons, everything that you've said about testing miracles could, of course, be applied to the New Testament miracles, both those of Jesus and of the apostles. How would you respond to that?
And who was born blind, who can now see. There's no one alive who remembers him. There's no one other testimony. We have got the testimony given in the Gospels. And I think we've just got to park it. The decision of our attitude is going to be on the much wider picture, and not least the issue of the resurrection of Christ. If God has demonstrated Jesus to be the Son of God by raising him from the dead, it will alter our attitude to all those stories. It is then not surprising that the finger of God was found in the activity of Christ. And clearly the apostles, yes. I mean, they claimed that this was a sign of them being apostles, that they worked miracles. So I think there is a surprising, to come back to Elizabeth's point, there is a surprising lack of comment about miracle healing in the letters. There's a reference to the gift of miracles, but we don't get the impression that they were experiencing regular miracles. We learn of Trophimus, who was left behind sick, and the fellow who nearly died, and Paul's thorn in the flesh, which I assume is a physical illness of some sort. There were no miraculous answers for them.
It's Robbie Morris. I'm a professor at the Institute of Psychiatry. There are two aspects. I wondered if you could flesh out your distinction between things being medically unexplained and being a miracle, which is, I find quite interesting. And also, are there any comments on mental health, which is another issue, or maybe that's too wide an issue?
Thank you. If we take the story of Dr. Mary Self, she had this mark on her scan, which was, a routine follow-up scan, because she'd previously had this a metastatic cancer, and so that they were clearly worried about her. They see this mark, and they then try and find out what it is. So they did a biopsy on it. They isolated the bit of bone, but they didn't find malignant cells. So they still don't know what caused the mark on the scan. And I'm afraid that is one of the problems with all medical investigations and why you shouldn't allow yourself to be bullied either by your employer or your family to have regular checkups and x-rays and all the rest of it, because they will find quite as much nonsense as they're ever likely to find that's really helpful. There's a lot of evidence that routine checks are detrimental to health. This is just a rather embarrassing and salutary. Well, he needs to be wary. I mean, I'm under a doctor at the moment for my skin thing. He's an absolute enthusiast. He's taken bits of my skin off all over the place. I'm getting thoroughly fed up with it. Only one of them was a bit dubious, but he can't be sure. I think we'd better be safe. And, you do these tests, and they can be very misleading. So it's not surprising there was a mark on her. They were looking for marks on her pelvis that could be a problem. They found one. What's that? We don't know. Let's go in after it. Let's dig it out. They never proved it. It was presumably of no consequence. Or it may have been a cancer that resolved in answer to her prayers, or spontaneously resolved, although I think the sort of cancer she had, that would have been very unlikely.
Oh,
that's a relief.
It's true. We made you work very hard.
Thank you.